dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. The question of how we want to live our lives, both individually and collectively, lies at the heart of all the problems we face and how we solve them. Whether we're talking about preventing the destruction of rural New York by hydrocarbon corporations or the collapse of the planet's biosphere because of people that will not let go of a destructive social system. In the parlance of Charles Eisenstein, whether we survive and move to an age of reunion or extinguish ourselves and most everything else, clinging to the deck chairs of the age of separation. The question of how we live our life was the topic of a wide-ranging discussion between author Derek Jensen, activist Red Moon Song, and students at the University of Connecticut last month. The discussion lasted for 3 hours, so I've had to leave out a lot, as well as make edits, due to the presence of words that I and most everyone I know use on a daily basis, but which are not allowed on the radio. So I apologize in advance for that. Before we get to the presentation, I want to remind local listeners in the Finger Lakes that Life is Water, a benefit concert to raise money to defend the Finger Lakes from unsafe gas drilling, will be held December 5th at the State Theater in Ithaca. Donna the Buffalo, the Sim Redman Band, and the Horseflies have all donated their time to raise funds in support of the Shale Shock Citizens Action Alliance, a dedicated group of community members working to defend us from being turned into a toxic hellhole by gas drilling corporations. You can have fun and do good at the same time by attending the concert. That's Saturday, December 5th at 8 p.m. at the State Theater on State Street in downtown Ithaca. Tickets are available at the State Theater box office, and they are reserved seating ranging in price from $12.50 to $24.50. You can buy tickets online through a link on the Shale Shock website, as well as get information on the Marcellus shale gas drilling issue at shaleshock.org. So now our feature presentation, a dialogue with Derek Jensen, Red Moon Song, and students from the University of Connecticut.
Hi, thank everybody for coming. Welcome. I know a lot of people came from far away, so thank you. I'm Stephanie Molden. I'm from the UConn Free Press, who is sponsoring this event. I don't know if you've seen our newspapers anywhere. And we're welcoming Derek Jensen, the author of Endgame, Songs of the Dead, The Culture of Make-Believe, and How Shall I Live My Life on Liberating Earth from Civilization. And we're also welcoming my friend Red Moon Song. She's a veteran activist, and she's from an eco-village in North Carolina. She's here to balance Derek's perspective as we talk. I wanted to bring them here because as I've gone through my undergraduate education, I'm graduating soon, I've learned all these things about the world, and I'm having a hard time putting them together into a cohesive perspective. So I learn about things like violence against women, racism, problems we have with the environment now, philosophy, human rights, and how do we put all these things together? Why is that important? How are we going to live our lives when we leave here? And did anybody think about that? Okay, good. So I met Red Moon Song this summer at her Eco Village, and she was like, "You need to read Derek Jensen." So I did as soon as I got home, and every morning I would wake up and I'd be like, "Mom, did you know this about slavery?" And she'd be like, "You're crazy." But it meant a lot to me, and so I do some activism work here at UConn, and I wanted my activist friends up in the corner to get a new perspective about all the work they're doing. And for everyone else who has, sounds like a lot of people have heard of Derek Jensen, so maybe a lot of people interested in environmentalism. Yeah? Good. And I wanted anybody who likes to ask the question, why? You know, when you're five and you're like, "Mom, why is the sky blue?" And she's like, "Because it's, you know, this." But you're like, "But why?" And, you know, you learn in school about racism and your teachers are like, "Oh, well, class, gender, and sex, blah, 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 blah." We're like, "Yeah, but why? Why are people hating each other? Why are they doing this?" And then if we know why, then we can work on fixing it. And that's why I wanted to bring these two wonderful people here to talk to you. So with that, I would like to introduce Derek Jensen.
Before we start, I would like to thank the UConn Free Press and Red Moon Song and Undergraduate Student Government.
They paid for it.
Stephanie has done something quite extraordinary, which is normally when coalitions bring me, it's a coalition of like I was just in Chico 2 days ago, and when I thanked the organization and people who brought me, I thanked like 8 people and 4 organizations. And in this case, the coalition who brought me was consisted of Stephanie, and then Stephanie. Okay, so the next thing is, we have discussed 11 times now how we're going to handle this evening, what we're going to do, because some of our options were...
Let Derek talk for 2 hours by himself.
Yeah, and you sleep.
Right.
Or let you talk for 2 hours by yourself and I sleep. We
Two
could each of us talk for, you know, 20 minutes and then go to Q&A. Or another possibility we're thinking is that we were thinking we could just go straight to Q&A, and that might actually be pretty fun. And your response is absolutely overwhelming. It's just, yeah, it's a great idea there. Really. So actually what we're thinking is that since we live in a democracy, which is actually my best joke of the night,
I guess so.
That we could take a vote. And then we take a vote right now. And then what we do is we take a vote, and then we act like it's a real democracy, and we just ignore you and do whatever we want.
Right, then
we
discuss it as well.
Unless, of course, any of you have any campaign contributions, in which case we will listen very closely. Because we were actually having a great time just chatting. We were thinking we could just ignore you and just chat, and that would actually be a really fun time. We're going to go the same amount of time anyway. We're going to go probably 2 or 3 hours. So you're not going to get ripped off on time here, no matter how we do it. How many people want to go straight to Q&A? 2? Do you have any money?
Yes. No.
Yeah. Well, then we don't care what you think anyway, do we?
I have other services.
All right.
Yeah. That's great. Okay, so it's looking like they don't really want to go straight to Q&A.
Yeah, it looks that way.
Okay.
Half
what and half what? I don't know what that means.
You don't know what half and half means?
Well, it has a whole bunch of different definitions. I don't know what it means in this circumstance. What does that mean?
Talk for an hour, you two, amongst yourselves, and then Q&A for an hour, or something like that.
Okay. Wait, I need more clarification. Because now, are you saying that you'd want like her to talk for a while, me to talk for a while? You want us just to chat like we were before, and then y'all just sort of eavesdrop? You want us to do like an official talk from each of us that adds up to an hour?
Make sure this is in triplicate, whatever
triplicate.
You are putting down.
Well, we're trying to give them what they want. Remember, you said we need to give them what they want.
She said that. I know.
And I'm trying to figure out what they want. How do you figure out what they want? Communicating.
Okay.
That's what I'm trying to do. Communication.
Okay.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I don't care. We don't care. I mean, here's the deal. It's your evening because It's like that's a problem with school in general, is that when I used to teach, I hate that word, when I used to be an educator, I recognized that the hierarchy in school is entirely backwards, that people always think that the students are basically there to do what the teacher says, who is there to do what the administrators say, who are there to do what the president says. But school is there for students. And so actually it was my job to be the servant to the teacher, the students. And then it was the administrator's job, really, to be my servant. And yeah, hierarchy, whatever. And then it was the administrator's job, the president's supposed to serve them. I mean, really, school exists for students. And then this night exists for you. This night does not exist for me. And so would you want for us to just continue the, I thought, extremely interesting conversation we were having before? Or would you want for us to each do a little presentation?
Presentation.
A familiar format.
Okay. Well, as long as we're doing that, so now, am I supposed to go first? You're supposed to go
first. See, this is the great part about being on stage with a radical feminist, is that they're always saying to you, do you want to go first? You can go first if you want to. Do you want to? Do you want to make that decision? Are you sure that's what we want to do? Do you want to talk about it again? Like, that's right. Say it.
You go first. Okay. You want me to go first? I'll go first. I don't care.
Well, no, I think I'll go first.
Okay.
So one of the things that interested me in an article that Derek wrote that I read was about somebody asking about toilet paper, taking shorter showers, blah, 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 and how that's not the answer. And I am a person who is very interested in voluntary simplicity lifestyles. And so I try to encourage people to get as radical as possible in their lifestyles, which means taking shorter showers, paying attention to the toilet paper to use. I rarely even use toilet paper, okay? So I've moved into this next phase, which is a little more radical than the kind of toilet paper you use. But that being the way it is, my whole theory is based on a phrase that I use frequently, which is, what you don't spend, you don't have to earn. What you don't spend, you don't have to earn. So if you can learn to live a radical lifestyle where you use very few resources, you live in community with your friends, you conserve energy like crazy, you don't have a lot of bills to pay, I don't have utility bills to pay, you don't have all that stuff, and you can live on very, very, very small amounts of money, which means you've got enormous amounts of time to do what you think you are called to do, what you're, in a native way, they'd say, your sacred task. What is your sacred task? And you would have the time to examine that sacred task and prepare for that sacred task and serve your community with whatever your sacred task is, and you'd have enough time to do that. So for me, the whole idea of living a lifestyle of voluntary simplicity has to do with understanding what you really need and what you don't really need, and beginning to move your needs to your wants and your wants to your desires, and then your desires kind of just go off that way someplace else. And so you really know who you are and what you need in order to serve and function in this world. So that's my basic premise. So now we can argue about the details if you want. We could do that. What kind of toilet paper do you use? If it's really soft toilet paper, it's from virgin forests. If it's harder toilet paper, it's from recycled paper. Uh-oh. Restaurant napkins.
I'm on the road. So whenever there's a paper napkin, I always take it home, even after I use it. And then, by the way, after I use it, it goes in the worm bin.
In the worm bin.
Yeah, they love the poop.
Do you take it home? Is that where you have the worm bin?
I poop at home. I don't take this. I don't use this on the road and then take the used toilet paper home.
I'm just asking what you do at your house.
Yeah. Here, this is one I used last night. I agree. And as we were saying earlier, my problem with a lot of the voluntary simplicity people is there are a lot of people who use that as a means to an end, who say that that's a means to an end, that somehow taking a shorter shower or composting is going to stop this corporate culture that's killing the planet. And that's just insane. But I absolutely agree that, I mean, I've written before, but see, we've already gone off our format.
Who cares?
I know, that's it.
Because the format's more important than what's happening right now. Damn it.
There's a friend of mine who says that a lot of activists begin by wanting to protect a specific piece of ground and end up questioning the foundations of Western civilization. Because they're trying to protect this place, but then they start asking, why is this place getting destroyed? And then once you start asking those questions, the questions spiderweb their way out. I know it's the same for a lot of women. They start asking, why do women get raped? And then, women do not get raped.
Right.
Why do men rape women?
That's right.
And then the questions will spiderweb their way out. And you can ask, why does this culture kill indigenous cultures? Questions spiderweb the way out. And for me, in many ways, it started because I didn't want to get a job. And I was in college, and I used to ask people if they liked their jobs. About 90% would say no. And what does it mean when the vast majority of people spend the vast majority of their waking hours doing things they don't want to do? It seemed crazy to me. When I was in college, a lot of my friends were, it's like, we hated school. In fact, I hated school so much, I went back to grad school twice. But I would say, you know, what are you going to do about the fact that you hate school? And I said, well, when I get out, I'm going to buy myself a really nice car. And I had friends who were actually looking forward to the day they would retire when they were 65. And I knew that what would happen is that if I worked for 40 years or however many, and then I retired, the next day I would get hit by a bus. This is just what's going to happen. And so I couldn't see spending my life doing what I didn't want to do. And a lot of it for me came down to the song Taking Care of Business by Bachman-Turner Overdrive, which I heard when I was like 16, and the song changed my life. So, I mean, so discourse matters. Anyway, the song goes, you get up every morning from your alarm clock's warning, take the 8:15 to the city. There's a whistle up above and people pushing, people shove, and all the girls trying to look pretty. Well, if your train's on time, you can get to work by 9, start your slaving job and get your pay. But if you ever get annoyed, look at me, I'm self-employed. I love to work at nothing all day. Which was just music to my 16-year-old ears. Before then, I was a good capitalist. And then after that, I was like, darn, I don't want to get a job. And so for me, in some ways, yeah, my environmental concerns began when I was a kid, when I saw subdivisions going in to these beautiful places that I loved. When I was 8 and 9, I recognized you can't have an infinite growth on a finite planet. That's just insane. And then also, you know, with my father's violence, I recognized that his violence wasn't making him happy. Why are people doing these crazy behaviors that aren't making them happy? And then, you know, that was just, you know, parked in there somewhere. Park, that's a car word. That was just resting in there somewhere, waiting to germinate.
Planted in there.
Planted, thank you. It was planted in there. And then the BTO song came along when I was about 16, and that broke the seed capsule. I'm not going to take this metaphor very much further. And then it took a few more years for it to really sprout. And I'm going to stop now. But the point is that I was not at a stage yet where I recognized that I wanted to not get a job so I could serve the larger community. All I knew when I was 20 is I didn't want to get a job. And then it took me through my mid-20s to figure out that what I need to do, that I was given a life, and it is my responsibility to give back something back to my community for that beautiful gift that I've been given. And so it took me, you know, I think that developmentally it's actually pretty appropriate for late teens and early 20s to be as narcissistic as they often are. I don't mean to talk about you like you're not here. But I think that's really important, can be important developmentally. It was for me, because you need to figure out who the hell you are, and you certainly haven't been told the story since you're a child about how to be a human being. I know for me, I spent a lot of my 20s vomiting up the effects of coercive schooling and trying to figure out what it means to be a human being. And then once I started figuring out in my late 20s, then it's like, okay, what am I going to do about this? And part of being a human being, no, part of being a living being is to serve your community. Mm-hmm. And so, take this back to the beginning, that's where I really fall apart with some of the, obviously not you from everything you've said, but where I fall apart with some of the people who think of simple living as an end. Because a compost pile would not have stopped Hitler. And what we need is a culture of resistance, and what we need is serious political organizing, and we need to build a militant resistance that will stop this culture from killing the planet. Militant, non-militant, I don't give a shit.
What do you think of civilian defense? Have you heard anything about civilian defense? It's kind of the thing like they did in Czechoslovakia, I think, in 68 when the Russians came in and the Czechoslovakian people like hid all the street signs. They put all the food underground. So when the soldiers came in, they were totally lost. They had no food. And it was, I think, 100 people were killed before the Russian soldiers left. But The idea of civilian defense being all the people learn from the time that we're children. We learn self-defense. We learn resistance. The exact kind of things you're talking about. The independence that it seems like the soul is, it's necessary for us to be able to create a social system that's much more balanced and where everybody, not the standing army routine, as much as every person within the society having survival skills, knowing these various things so that we can function with more, you know, with more respect for each other as a whole, like having those skills to begin with.
I think that that is crucial, and I think that that has been part of every resistance, successful resistance movement that has been. Only 2% of the IRA ever picked up weapons. 98% is doing support work.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
I love to poke fun at pacifists, but Harriet Tubman carried a gun, but the Quakers did not. And what we really need to do is to figure out how to work together. The U.S. Patriots, you know, the four parents. The four parents, one of the things they did, as well as trying to, well, amass their own personal wealth because they were assholes, one of the things that they did was they built up alternate institutions at the same time that they're opposing the British. So they built up their own court system. Do people know this history? Yes? No? Oh, it's fascinating. They built up alternative court systems because they didn't respect the British courts. And one of the things they did is they made, in Massachusetts, and I think in Connecticut, but I'm sure in Massachusetts, they made their own court system that had no enforcement because it didn't have the power of the state behind it, but it had the power of communal enforcement. You say that I trespassed on your property. That's a whole other question of trespassing, but we'll just go with that because I don't want to say I punched you.
Okay.
Well, I don't say I punched you. Whatever.
Okay.
Okay, so instead of taking it to the British court, they would take it to the local court, and then the local court would impose a sentence upon me. And actually, because I'm a male hitting a woman, they probably wouldn't have done anything. But set that aside. The court would have imposed a sentence which the community would have enforced. And so you see this with the Spanish anarchists setting up their own school systems. We've all heard about the Spanish anarchists with their school systems.
Mm-hmm.
And Kropotkin talked about how so many revolutions are founded on bread because there's no way for the people to feed themselves. And I'm going to go a different direction and say that Darjamail, he's great, he's one of my heroes. Darjamail did not like how the U.S. government, the corporate media, was covering the invasion of Iraq. He was just a standard person up in Alaska, and he didn't like how the corporate media is covering it. So what am I going to do? I'm going to go cover it right. So he just went over there. And I was talking to him one time, and he told me about the defense of Fallujah. And, you know, Fallujah held out for about 2 weeks against the U.S. military.
Mm-hmm.
The defense of Fallujah was not organized. It was neighborhood by neighborhood. There was no overarching organization. It was the individual neighborhoods. They picked up their guns, and they're going to stop the U.S. military. And there's a lot to be said for that. And once again, we see that with the IRA. We see that all through history. We see this, the importance of having an entire culture of resistance where everything you do, once again, whether, I mean, Maud Gunn, we talked about her on the way up, was her son became chief of staff of the IRA and later founded Amnesty International, won the Nobel Peace Prize. She started, really, with the Gaelic literature revival. And that's the importance of Gaelic literature for the Irish resistance.
Mm-hmm.
And then she found that nonviolent resistance wasn't working and through a generation because they did the whole Irish land movement and that succeeded in great measure, but it also had, there were a lot of casualties and they realized that they needed to move to militant resistance. So my point is that all these are intermeshed.
Mm-hmm. Well, see, this is what happened from me becoming more acquainted with your books this year because I've been a nonviolent activist for 30 years or whatever. I think the first time was surrounding the Pentagon. Was that 1980 or something like that? And I was support for 7 Greenpeace people who were getting arrested who handcuffed themselves together. Don't ever handcuff yourself together in an action because the police will just kick your hands and you can break your wrists. It's really foolish, but I didn't know that at the time. So I was their support person. And so I've been using that nonviolent support and getting arrested, whatever, at the test site or getting arrested in D.C. or getting arrested in a wide variety of places for what, you know? And so they take you in. I mean, I wrote something last year about spending the night with the Capitol Police because a bunch of us got arrested at a big thing. And they kept us overnight and we were on the buses with our hands, whatever. So I was thinking to myself, what is the point of this? I mean, I'm there to put my body there, okay, because I'm, you know, an old lady, and I think as an old lady I'm supposed to put my body out there. And there was a bunch of other gray-haired people there too, so it was fine. And it cost $150, and, you know, we got to sit overnight and talk to the Capitol Police, and they didn't even use computers. They were doing everything by hand. And normally I support doing everything by hand because I don't use computers either, but I thought the Capitol Police, you know, that just didn't go with me, right? So I've been rethinking what would be more useful for me. Is it useful for me to continue to get arrested in these nonviolent processes when I've been doing this, I mean, 40 years, 35, 40 years with friends, and I've been vegetarian. I mean, you know, the whole, all of the above. And so one of the things which reading your stuff did for me is it caused me to start talking to all the people in my community, of course, and people that I've been active with for a long time who are avowed nonviolent people. And it's been causing me to think, what am I willing to do? I mean, from everything I understood about the Gandhi thing, the reason he was able to be nonviolent was because there was other people in the background, you know, just like Martin Luther King, he could be nonviolent because there was somebody saying, by any means necessary, in the background. And so I was thinking to myself, well, how much are the people that I've learned who are able to use nonviolent tactics, that's what I've been taught, nonviolent tactics, to succeed in political stuff, overthrowing the British, what have you, how much has that only been possible because there was this threat from the other side? And so I've really been considering that a lot more and saying, okay, well, what is my place now as a woman who's 64 years old, who's been an activist for a long time? What is my obligation to these next generations? What is my obligation to everything that you're talking about at this point in my life? And so I want to appreciate you for bringing these particular interstitial weavings into my consciousness so that I can reflect on that and act in the way I've been acting, but what might be the next step for me coming from the background I'm coming from, which is I love thought-provoking stuff, so I just appreciate your thought provocations.
Well, thank you for that, and I really appreciate your extensive work and extensive history of work, because that's one of the things also that I think we all need to remember is that we have to be in this for the long haul, even though at this point there is no long haul.
Right.
You know, 120 species went extinct today.
Yeah.
And 120 species will go extinct tomorrow and the day after and the day after. And there is this tremendous urgency. And at the same time, we have to recognize that there has to be this continuity. It's like, how many people here have seen the movie Battle of Algiers? Great movie. Best movie ever on insurgency. The movie is about the Algerian insurgency against the French. And I was watching this movie with a friend of mine, and I said, so, who would I be in this movie? And I was just asking for strokes. You know, my friend was supposed to say, oh, you'd be the really brave one. And my friend said, oh, you'd be dead. Yeah, thank you very much. And my friend said, no, you're dead for 30 years, and your books are on the bookshelves of all the insurgents. That one of the things we need to do is we need to build an entire culture of resistance. And part of that has to do with this moving through the understanding. I mean, every resistance, it's so interesting. The French resistance in World War II, you know, well, a couple things about it. One of them is that you know, we think about them, you know, bravely attacking the Nazis or whatever, but most of those resistance movements went through an evolution where at first, what you have to do is basically pray for the souls of the Germans and withdraw your support for them and then send them loving kindness, you know, and hope that they will change. And then, didn't work. Okay? Well, it's okay if you let the air out of their tires, but you got to make sure to let them know so they don't, like, try to drive on a flat tire and really bum them out. Didn't work. And so they kept moving step by step until by 1944, even the priests were calling for, they're saying it's okay to kill, to assassinate German officers. So there's this evolution that goes through, and you see this consistently. The Movement for the Emancipation of Niger Delta, you know, Ken Saro-Wiwa was a nonviolent activist, and he was murdered by the Nigerian government at the behest of the oil corporations. His son helped with MEND making the transition, and MEND now says to the oil companies and to the employees, pretty much a direct quote, it must be clear that the government cannot protect you. Leave our land now or die in it. They've been able to reduce oil output in Nigeria by 20%. And, you know, here they talk about
cap and trade, you know, it would be very easy to reduce U.S. oil output by 20%. I asked Dar Jamail how long a bridge would last in Iraq if it wasn't guarded. He said, oh, between 6 and 24 hours. One of the things that my work is really about is about attempting to create a real resistance movement that is commensurate with the problems that we're facing. It's like a couple things. One is, I shared the stage about a year ago with Vandana Shiva, Kathy Pedler, and this nun whose name I never can remember, and she does this great anti-war activism. And we're all, all of us up on stage are recognizing we don't live in a democracy. And anybody in here, we're going to have a little vote. How many people think that the U.S. government takes better care of corporations or human beings? Corporation or human beings first? Bunch of communists. How many people think the government takes better care of corporations? I think it's consensus. Okay, so I asked. We all understood this on stage, and we all in the audience, and everybody in the audience understood this. And then I turned to the nun to the left of me, and I said, so if you fully internalize the understanding that we don't live in a democracy, and you want to stop the war in Iraq, how would this affect your activism? How would this change how you behave? And she turned to me and said, I have no idea. And we know none of us have any idea, because we're all laboring under this illusion that we live in a democracy. We're all pretending. I mean, that's why I hate those nature programs. A bunch of reasons I hate the nature programs. But one of them is that they always end. It's like, oh yeah, okay, this is being destroyed. Write your representative. You know what? I don't have a representative. Representative Mike Thompson, Northern California, he represents Monsanto. Sorry, he doesn't represent me. And I was reading a great book yesterday on the plane. It's called The Rising of the Moon by Flynn Connelly. I really recommend it. It has this cheesy science fiction cover, and there's like cheesy science fiction stuff in the first five pages. But what it's really about is about a feminist revolution in a futuristic papist Ireland. And it's step by step how the women start a revolution. And it's great. And there was a line that she had me thinking because of this. Before we can begin to use power on our own terms, we must realize that we're powerless on theirs. Much of the brilliance of the democratic experiment, that's what we live in, is to con the powerless into believing they have power. When it finally becomes clear to even the most obtuse that we, the people, are powerless, the next twist of the screw is to convince us that our power lies in our power to consume or not consume, or in our attempts to become enlightened. But only when we realize that we are powerless in all these ways will we be moved to use the power in ways that really affect change. I think that's one of the big cons we've been faced with, is that the belief that we actually have power within this system. The system has been set up from the beginning to protect those in power. And we all like to laugh at, oh, back in the 1980s, the Soviets, you know, in the Politburo, it was like 98% Communist Party members. Well, what percentage of the U.S. House of Representatives and Senate are Capitalist Party members? You know, it's like, who's laughing now? Yeah, 100%. It's worse than the Politburo.
Yeah.
And so this, I mean, I'm not the first. I mean, Noam Chomsky talked about this with the two-party, one-party system. And it's just, and that's another thing. We get conned all the time in all of our civics classes about, oh, you know, there's all these checks and balances between the different houses of government. Well, let's fuck that bullshit. Because, I'm sorry, where are the checks and balances between the rich and the poor? I mean, those are the ones we care about. Where are the checks and balances between the power of corporations and, say, living rivers?
You know, I have a copy of The Great Law of Peace from the Hodanasazi up there, the whole deal. And it's right next to the Constitution. So it's really interesting because they said that, you know, we took a lot of our Constitution from what the great law of the Iroquois Confederacy, which theoretically had six nations or seven nations that had worked together for thousands of years and had managed to figure out ways to conduct themselves and govern themselves in a peaceful way. So I've got a copy that's got the Great Law of Peace here and it's got the Constitution here. And so I looked at what the idea of checks and balances were from the Great Law of Peace. And what it was is the women chose a man to be a chief executive, which is what I think is a really good role for men, that they be chosen to be the executive. The women say, we need a safe place to live, and we need a place for our kids to be safe, and the men say, you got it. That's what I want to see. That's what I'd like to see. So if the man screwed up, Then the women gave him two more times. Three is always the magic number, although with Native people it's mostly fours that are spiritual, whatever. So they gave him two more times, and if it goofed, then he was replaced. They got another chief executive that was going to support what the people needed to be done. And the women were also the judges. So these were the checks and balances that were more originally done from those Native peoples, which the United States government obviously did not copy that part. Because I think we as women got the vote in 1920. We had nothing to say about designing the damn thing. I said, why do I want the vote for what some rich white boys decided in 1776? This is not my government. I much prefer a government that's parliamentarian or something where if we want to vote green and there's 6% of our votes green, we get 6% of the seats or something. I would love something that was representational. I would love to be a good citizen in a really democratic culture, that we were really working with each other, for each other, and considering what else is going on. It's really, really frustrating to want to serve and to want to have a place where your kids are safe and where animals are safe and where Earth is safe and where we're living in such a way, like permaculture, or like ideally we would use energy, like the wind. You know, it passes through, we use it, and it goes, keeps going, and it's not polluted, it's not messed up, it's not wasted. It's just a way of living that's a sustainable way of living. I would love to do that, and I would pay taxes if I needed to pay money to groups of people who are willing to do that. As it is, I refuse to pay taxes, and I won't support war, and I've been doing that all my life. I paid $647 in my life so far for Social Security. And I will never get Social Security because I haven't worked enough cash time in my life to be able to get Social Security. But $647 towards, that's not bad. That's not bad. So it is, there's some of this stuff is possible, and it's certainly something to think about and reflect on. Now, you were going to take a minute off, right? Isn't that where we went? You were reading something, then you were going to take a minute? I'm sorry.
Oh, no. No, that's great. I want to check in. So how are you doing with the format so far? Is this okay?
Yeah.
Okay.
What is the name of that book that you were quoting from?
Oh, this one, which I haven't quoted from yet, but I'm going to.
You quoted?
No, I wrote that.
You wrote that?
Well, no, I'm so surprised.
I thought it was from the book, and I was thinking, that's really good, Derek. No, I want to read that book.
No, I wrote that yesterday.
Not bad, right?
The Rising of the Moon by Flynn Connolly. And Stephanie McMillan, my friend, introduced me to this book, and she said that she, and the politics are great all through this book, and she said that she contacted the author several years ago, and the author never wrote another book because it was received so poorly. Anyway, there's a couple quotes in here that I want to do from some Irish or American resistance people that I just loved. Henry David Thoreau said, "All men," and by that I hope he meant people, recognize the right to revolution, that is, the right to refuse allegiance to and to resist the government when its tyranny or its inefficiency are great and unendurable. That's a good one. James Connolly, the soul of Ireland, preached revolution, declared that no bloodletting could be as disastrous as a cowardly acceptance of the rule of the conqueror, nay, that the rule of the conqueror would necessarily entail more bloodletting than revolt against the rule. It's like we hear all the time, one of the things I talk about in my regular endgame talk is premise 4, which is one of my favorite premises of that book, which is that this culture has a rigidly defined yet often unarticulated hierarchy. And violence done by those higher on the hierarchy to those lower is invisible. It's unnoticed. And violence done by those lower on the hierarchy to those higher is unthinkable. And when it does happen, it's met with shock, horror, and the fetishization of the victims. And there's just a bazillion examples of this. One example is my own family. That my father was extremely violent. My brother has epilepsy from blows to the head. He broke my sister's arm. He raped my mother, my sister, and me. And the one time my brother fought back, he was beaten far worse than any other time because he committed blasphemy by sending violence up the hierarchy. That's one example. Another example would be bears. There's bazillions of bears where I live. I see them almost every day. And my mom has a great relationship with the bears. The mother bears bring their babies up to her. And she has great relationship. Except this year, it was so funny. One of the babies learned how to ring my mom's doorbell, which was really fun for about the first 6 hours.
Yeah, exactly.
And after that, it's like she now hates that. And she doesn't really. But it's like learn a different trick or something. And one day a bear was, my mom woke up and a bear was standing outside her door mooning her. Anyway, the point is that I walked through the forest and people are like, oh my God, Derek, you walked through the forest. Aren't you afraid that bears are going to kill you, you know? There's bears and bears and bears, oh my. And the thing is, what I know is that there's one person dies in North America every 2 years from a bear attack. And on the other hand, there's 46,000 people die every year in the United States from automobile accidents. So the truth is that we should, like, walk through a forest without a worry in the world, and then you walk through a parking lot, and it's like, oh. Another example, cops. Every day in the United States, between 4 and 6 people die because they encountered police. That's through beatings, shootings, high-speed chases, and medical neglect in prisons and jails. Every time a cop dies, a big state funeral, you know, bumper stickers, some gave all gave some. But on the other hand, the most dangerous civil service profession is garbage collection. Way, way more dangerous. When was the last time you saw a state funeral for a garbage collector? You know? When was the last time you saw a Tom Cruise movie where he's this intrepid garbage man who's cleaning up the mean streets of L.A.? It doesn't happen. Because it doesn't valorize the violence that flows down the hierarchy. And if you don't believe me on this whole cop thing, you know, try this whole thought experiment, which is the next time you go to some anti-war rally or some anti-globalization protest, take a baseball bat. And I walk up to a cop and say, it's the thought experiment, and say, excuse me, officer friendly, nothing personal, but I'm doing an experiment. And then hit him a couple more times real fast. And then I'll talk to him about 50 years. In Oklahoma, a woman was beaten to death by her husband, and he was sentenced to 7 years in prison. And then during the judicial process, he spat on a cop, and for that he was sentenced to life in prison. I don't understand what people are complaining about. I mean, that's the natural order, is it not? Man, woman, cop. I guess they have not been socialized enough. A few more years of school, you'll get it. I wasn't serious. That's an example. Oh, another example. And I feel a little bit weird saying this close to New York City, but 9/11. You know? I've started. I'm going to go ahead. There were about 3,000 people. I mean, I got to tell you, at least we in the West, I mean, frankly, we're really sick of hearing about 9/11. And we're the only people who are sick of hearing about 9/11. Okay, there's two of us. We can form a support group. Last time a politician did not mention 9/11 was 9/10. And there were 3,000 people died that day. There are 15,000 Americans die every 2 weeks from preventable cancers. There are 500,000 children die every year as a direct result of so-called debt repayment from non-industrialized nations to industrialized nations. I just learned this a couple days ago. There are 120,000 people die in the world every single day from the effects of pollution, directly from the effects of pollution. 120,000 every day. That's 49/11s. But those aren't violence. You know, it's only violence when it flows up the hierarchy. There's just so many examples. This is just all through. I mean, Jaws, you know? I live 3 miles from the ocean. I never stick my foot in the ocean. The reason? Because of the movie Jaws. And
I was in Florida with my kids when that movie came, and every time I tried to go in the water, my kids were like, Mama, don't go! It was horrible.
Exactly. And the ratio of human attacks on sharks to shark attacks on humans is 20 million to 1. I mean, so the shark's like swimming through the water, and they see some field bears, like, they start hearing that f***ing music, you know? One of the things that we've been deeply inculcated into believing is that it's okay for violence to flow down the hierarchy and not up. It also helped me understand homophobia, frankly, because I never understood homophobia before, because I always thought that if you don't like homosexuals, you probably just didn't date one. And then I finally understood it because of this conflation of sex and violence can only flow down, means that sex can only flow down. A while ago, I was listening to NPR. I'm so sorry. I only did it once, and I was in the car, and I was forced to. I've never done it again. Anyway, I was listening to NPR. At least it wasn't All Things Considered. And Small Things. That's great. I always call it Corporate Things Considered, but I like Small Things Considered better. I was actually listening to Small Things Considered one time, and this is 20 years ago. This is like the last time I ever took it seriously, and it had to do with this region. It was when George Bush the First was saying that the people who did not want taxes lowered on the rich, he was saying that the reason they didn't want that to happen is because they were like Puritans who did not want anybody else to be happy either. That if they're not having fun, they don't want anybody else to have fun. And that was his response. And so the response by Noah Adams, or whatever the hell his name is, on Small Things Considered, was
was, you know, they said that sentence, and they said, now, to really discuss this, we're going to ask someone, did the Puritans really not have fun? That was our political analysis. Anyway, I don't know why I'm staring at you when I say that. It's not your fault.
I don't know either. I'm just taking a drink.
Anyway, I was listening to NPR, and this military spokesman said, he's a man. It was important he's a man, actually. Spokesperson, whatever.
Thank you.
And maybe we can even disagree. That might be fun. We haven't disagreed yet, really.
Not really.
Okay. We'll try.
Okay.
Okay. Anyway, spokesperson is saying that the reason that homosexuals should not be allowed in the military is because, well, actually, I need to say before I go any further that I agree that homosexuals should not be allowed in the military. I feel that so strongly, that homosexuals should not be allowed in the U.S. military. But then again, I think that heterosexuals and transsexuals and bisexuals and asexuals should not be allowed in the U.S. military either. Unless each one had their own army, you know? It's like the bisexual brigade to the rescue or something. Anyway, so this military spokesperson is saying, can you imagine what would happen if a private, a heterosexual lieutenant... I was thinking, yeah, sure, I can imagine that, but that wasn't his point. he was saying it would destroy chain of command, and not because the lieutenant would fall in love with the private and not be able to order the private to his death, but instead, notice he said if a private has sex with a lieutenant, he did not say if a lieutenant has sex with a private, because within a patriarchy where sex and violence are conflated, and violence can only flow down, that means sex can only flow down, and man has to fuck woman, subject, verb, object, what that means is that you have to have a fucker and a fuckee. And the fuckee has to be lower on the hierarchy than the fucker. And if the fucker, and this is where homophobia comes in, because if the fucker and the fuckee are on the same level, then all the little tiny brains just seize up. It destroys the whole hierarchy.
Well, and one of the men has to play the part of a woman.
Yes.
That's a big
Absolutely.
Deal.
Absolutely. I'll do more quotes in a minute, but I want to hear about gender specificity and why that's bad.
I am a person that believes in gender-inclusive language. I have been this way for probably 25 years. I remember a letter that I wrote to Noam Chomsky, and Noam Chomsky at that time responded to letters. Because Noam Chomsky is also a linguist. Okay, so he writes this book, and I forget which one it was, 25 years ago. And at the beginning, he says, we're going to use the male pronoun in this book for convenience. So my question is, whose convenience is that? It's not mine, because as probably there's as many women that read Noam Chomsky stuff as men. And so whenever they put man, he, him, mankind, whatever, I got to go through this thing in my head and change it around and say, well, is he talking about a particular man? Is he pretending that this term means all of human beings? So I wrote him a letter, and I told him, I said, you're a linguist, you know, the importance of language, you know, and then at the bottom I would always put, I hope to see your increased consciousness reflected in your next work. Just to let them know I'm watching. To see what they're going to do. So he sent me a letter. He said the point was well taken and suggested that I read a couple of books about, you know, feminism and linguistics. And I thought, I don't need this book. Obviously, you know, someone else may need this book. But so by using gender-inclusive language, the exciting thing about that and the thing that I love the most about it is, first of all, I can get people to stop saying you guys. And so I suggest that they say y'all. It's one thing you can say. And since I'm now from North Carolina, I can say that. You can also say you guyans or you guyas. If you're into earth-based stuff like that. You can say folks. You can say, you don't have to man a booth. You can staff it. You can do, I mean, I can go through the paper every day and find all these places where they don't use gender-inclusive language. And I think it's unfortunate because our language so determines, just like you're talking about, this subject, object, verb type of thing, your language so determines the way you perceive reality. When I think about the Hopi language that doesn't have a future or a past tense, and I try to imagine even remotely thinking without a future or a past tense.
Some types of mushrooms have 25,000 genders.
I like that.
I just read that. I have no idea what that means. I mean, it changes how you think about sex.
Yeah, well, I would, especially in mushrooms.
Yeah. Anyway, sorry. Go ahead.
What is that?
It's 28,000 genders. It's not only multiple nucleus, but multiple chromosomes inside the nucleuses. It gives you like 99.98% outbreeding ability, and within its own species, only a within its own family unit, less inbreeding, so it promotes outbreeding.
I like that. And what book was that you saw that at? Do you remember?
Oh, I saw it in just a. It was a. I was reading about Amanitas.
Okay.
And then there was a reference to how many genders there, and then that reference. But that's nothing compared to the whatever one he said that has 28,000.
Yeah, if you look up Schizophyllum commune, there's a website by Rod Tullis out in Michigan where he really discusses gender in mushrooms and takes a few reads to understand.
All right, let's get it right. Here we go. So anyway, so it's an interesting thing, and even though so many women don't want to give up their thing of saying you guys, because I get a lot of resistance from women about this, and I've tried to find out why that is. I mean, just like when I was younger, I used to say, oh man, you know, like, because that was a hip thing to say in the 60s or 50s or whenever I was around that. But and I think that you guys is like part of being hip now for women or men. And it just is just very interesting when you begin to look at language and begin to say, okay, how much, like I always say, like verbs. Bucky Fuller always said, life is a verb. Okay, so when people talk about a creator as a noun, I can't relate. You say creating as a verb, and I can relate. So I can talk about creating and see that as a constant process, an ongoing evolutionary expansion thing. But when you make that into a noun, I don't relate to it, you know? So there's just so much in language, and I'm glad you brought that up.
You're listening to excerpts from a dialogue with Derek Jensen, Red Moon Song, and students from the University of Connecticut Storrs, recorded last month. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW, Warren. We continue.
Sam Harris, who makes me angry. One of the things he wrote is he was talking about how he was attacking Christianity, which is a fine and righteous thing to do. But he was saying that any Christian of the 14th century would be, if you resurrected the person would be a, quote, total ignoramus compared to people today. That science is really progressive as opposed to religion is the maintenance of dogma. And there's just so much bigotry in that statement. It's like, Sam, I would like you to meet Dante Alighieri. I would like you to meet William of Ockham. How about Catherine of Siena? And then there's the whole question of what is educated, which is why I brought this up, is that, you know, he lists astronomy, medicine, and all these other ways people today would be much, and geography, as ways people would be much more educated, much more informed. And it's like, okay, how many people tonight can name when the next new moon is?
Where's our specialist?
Exactly. It's like every 14th century, I'm guessing that 90% of the people in the 14th century would have known when the next new moon is. And I'm guessing most every indigenous child prior to the arrival of this culture would have known when the next new moon is. Could you, where is the nearest, name 10 species of edible plants and fungi within 100 yards of this place. I mean, how's that? Yeah. He's the one that's going to save us all. What we are educated, not educated, what we are informed about is, even about technology. You know what I know about computers? You push the little yellow, you push the little silver button, and the thing turns on. And then if it stops going, that's the technical term, then what I have to do is I pick up this piece of plastic and I dial these numbers. How the phone work? I don't know. And I ask my friend Eric, Eric, my computer's dead. What do I do now? That's what I know about technology. Yeah, our ignorance is astounding.
Forgive me, I hope. But it really bothers me, the elevation of our pet peeves about language and even our probably righteous crusades for gender neutrality in our speech, to elevate that to the level of ecosystem collapse in our discourse, our political lives, our activist lives. That bothers me.
I think he's saying we should change topic.
Oh, no, not at all.
Okay, I think it's not an either or. And I think that, okay, I hear you. I can't, I've gotten 1,008, I think it is, pieces of hate mail in the last 9 years, two of which were from right-wing people. The other 1,006 were from people complaining because of my casual use of the word or vegetarians complaining because I don't eat meat, because I eat meat, or car drivers complaining because, I mean, anti-car activists because I drive a car, or because I use the word PNTs. And there is this idea of there's a wretched cliche, but not seeing the forest for the trees. You know, it's like, and okay, 120 species, or however many I said, went extinct today. I mean, there's 10 times as much plastic as there is phytoplankton in many parts of the ocean. And I'm sorry, we're talking about words? Are you fucking out of your mind? What we need to do is we need to strap on and lay waste to all those motherfuckers, you know? And that is a fine and righteous impulse, which I do not disagree with in the slightest. That said, it's like, I agree and, you know? Because there is this desperate urgency. And I was at a deep green resistance workshop that I ran with Eric and Lierre, in Bellingham, Washington. And one of the, many of the exercises were about militant resistance. And if you want to ask about militant resistance, when we get done with this little exercise, ask it and I will be ready to just run with it, okay? I am delighted to talk about militant resistance. Or if you don't, that's fine too, I don't care. But the point is that having to do with all this is that, once again, I agree with you that there is a point at which things do become semantic. It's like, and then there's also, back to the DGR workshop, is many of the exercises were about militant resistance, and we also did things like some people were envisioning, you know, the militant sort of people was like, we did the A to B thing. How do we get from here, where we are in this psychopathic culture, to living sustainably? And different people broke into different groups according to what they were interested in. Whether it was, you know, the militant people was like, okay, how do we form paramilitary organizations? What do we do? What are the steps that resistance groups go through? How do you have a security culture? How do you form a paramilitary organization within a fucking panopticon? Okay? People are talking about how do we get from a non-rape culture, from a rape culture to a non-rape culture. You know, I love Andrea Dworkin's line, my prayer for women of the 21st century is harden your hearts and learn to kill. You know, that's part of how we get there. Another part of how we get there is as men standing in alliance with women, absolutely. And saying rape is not acceptable. And we males and we females are going to stop it. Okay, so that's all really important. That's all crucial. The point is that there was this one group that was talking about like what communities look like and, you know, what a democratic community looks like versus a non-democratic. They're talking about all this stuff. Okay, and they write down all these characteristics of how they're going to get to a democratic, sustainable community. And there was this good friend of mine in the audience. Her name's Waz. She's a Dakota woman. She's a Dakota Indian activist and writer. Anyway, so she's seeing all these things that the people are writing up on the board about what a sustainable community looks like, and she says, you know, there's something missing here, which is I don't see any acknowledgement that you're living on stolen land. And before you can have a sustainable community, you have to recognize that this is our land. This is not your land. And we need to start from that perspective. And that was all. And she said that, and she said it very nicely. And then some people responded very well, and some people got very defensive. The point is that at one point, the guy who had actually organized the thing turned around to her and he said, you know, the world's being killed. I can't deal with this mental masturbation of whose land is it, because right now the salmon are being killed. And that led to a really interesting conversation because it is Dakota land. You know, whose land is this right here?